welcome to Little Fictions on Air. I'm Kate Liston Mills, your host. In today's episode, we will listen to a short fiction by Piers Newton-John. Piers's stories have featured on previous Little Fictions episodes, and his collection of short stories, Fault Lines, can be found on the Spineless Wonders website. Before we begin the story, I would like to read you an interview I had with the author so that we may get some background to where this story begins. So what is the most memorable short story you have read, and why does it stand out for you? Piers said, "If pressed to name a single one, I'd have to go for Kafka's The Metamorphosis. It is a nightmare put on paper, distilling the horror hidden in a certain kind of ordinary existence. The image of a man suddenly and inexplicably transformed into a grotesque insect could be read as an allegory for many things. Mental illness, neurotic self-rejection, the fate of a sensitive man in a bourgeois, materialistic society. But what makes it great literature is that almost everyone who reads it shudders with an obscure sense of recognition. Somehow it is a universal nightmare." So how would you describe your own writing? Piers said, "I suppose I veer towards the melancholic, the elegiac, sometimes the blackly comedic. Writing is no fun if you're not expressing forbidden thoughts and feelings. In my case, it seems to be the suspicion that things are more awful than we like to admit. The freedom of writing is honesty, unglossed by our usual defensive manoeuvres. Yet, I think there's an aesthetic sensibility to my writing that brings a redemptive touch, even if the story is black. I treat my characters with empathy and sensitivity, even while I torture them." So where do the ideas for your stories come from? Take us through an example. Piers responded, "Autobiography is always a great starting point, though the stories seldom remain there. Autobiography is like an armature you can put on, you can build on. It can give you the confidence and the structure to start crafting something. Then slowly the thing starts to want to take its own shape. And eventually the real events are so deeply buried only I, the author, can still make out the rough bones of them underneath. Sometimes the story starts with someone else's life. The Thief, about a jazz guitarist in the late 60s, was based on my old jazz guitar teacher who died sadly of a stroke a number of years ago. He told me once about how he had heard A Whiter Shade of Pale for the first time on the radio while driving in his combi van, and how much it had moved him. I imagined the circumstances of that moment, and it became the seed for the whole story." So what is your writing process from idea to publication? Do you go it alone or are others involved? Piers said, "It begins in anguish and procrastination. I always have many ideas, none of which seem quite good enough. I start many, many more stories than I finish, a bad habit, because in truth I believe that the failure of a story should not be an endpoint. It should be the beginning of the next incarnation, born from the ashes of the last through a process of understanding what went wrong. Many of my final stories are like that, refined from countless cycles of death and rebirth, like the Buddha. Still, I suffer from the delusion that perhaps this time writing won't be such hard work. As for the involvement of others, yes, I absolutely believe in that and rely on it. I have a hearty bond of reliable critics whose feedback I always solicit before sending my work anywhere. A good writing group is gold." The full interview with Piers can be found on the Spineless Wonders website. Now to today's story, Salt. Salt explores the experience of caring for a loved one as they die. When we read fiction about death and caring, we are often provided with a romanticized version, either about the strength and suffering of the person dying, or the patience, kindness, and love given by the carer. But salt brings us into the mind of a woman caring for her dying father, embracing all the emotions involved with such obligations. Those of love, strength, frustration, and extreme fatigue. The protagonist is portrayed as a fallible human being, her world a mix of obligation and desperation. As you listen to this story, consider how you would conduct yourself under these circumstances. What are your weaknesses and tipping points when it comes to situations of high emotional and mental stress? Perhaps you can consider how you hope to behave as the receiver of care in this situation. In this story, the person who is sick and dying is not particularly loving or patient. In fact, he seems exactly the opposite, and comes across as rather entitled by his illness to being horrid to his caregiver. This is Salt by Piers Newton-John.
When Norma stopped driving, she had reached the edge of the moon. Or so it seemed through the windscreen of Jack's Hiace as she sat, stunned by the silence. She stepped out of the van and looked up, breathed in a lungful of cold stars. The only sounds she could detect in that whole immensity were those she'd brought with her. The sound of her own life moving through her, breath and blood, and the van ticking as its heat bled away into the night. She walked to the edge of the luminous expanse that lay ahead in the moonlight and crouched down to crumble the white rime between her fingers. She touched the crystals against her tongue and felt them burn and melt, her mouth flooding with saliva. And then she walked. And then she ran out onto the great emptiness of Lake Torrens. And she kept running with her eyes closed until her heart hurt from pounding and her breath rang harsh in her ears. When she opened her eyes, she could no longer find Jack's van in the dark. She'd lost all reference points. She'd come as far as she could. So she laid herself out on the salt, faced the silent stars, and prepared herself for the tide of pain that was already rising in her bones. 9 months earlier, in a room 1,000 miles east, Norma's father, Jack, lay strangling in an upstairs bedroom. It was late summer and the room stank, a gagging combination of Jack's sick sweat, antiseptic feces, and something else that Norma assumed was the cancer. Jack had a buzzer installed beside his bed so he could summon Norma whenever he needed her. Inevitably, it was for some repulsive chore. To hold a wad of tissues in front of his mouth while he half-coughed, half-puked great gobs of blood-blackened phlegm, or to remove his bedpan, swilling with watery shit so evil-smelling she nearly retched as she tipped it down the toilet. She, who had spent 20 years changing bedpans. His humiliation made him hate her. She could see the baleful fervour in his eyes as they followed her over the oxygen mask. He no longer had the breath to yell, but to have his abuse whispered into her ear from 6 inches away, his hand clawing her arm and spittle on his lips, was somehow worse. She recoiled from the vile intimacy of it. The cancer, which had started in his lungs, had cauliflowered through his body, every scan revealing some new cluster of florets blossoming in the viscera. The doctors had sent him home to die with a morphine pump he could control himself, pressing a button whenever he needed to top up the dose. She knew his oncologist from her nursing days, a tired man with the eyes of a bloodhound. He had tried to help. He was sympathetic to her fears, promised her with meaningful emphasis that the morphine would be as plentiful as needed. But Jack's body was tough. Its roots twined deep into the life, and disease had one hell of a job prying him loose of it. It coiled and knotted, and the old man wore an expression of utter concentration as he battled the thing, locked in its unrelenting clinch. Before he got his buzzer, he tormented her with his querulous cries of, "Norma!" repeated 20 times a day in exactly the same cadence. That now seemed preferable to the peremptory bark of that cursed buzzer. Sometimes he'd just lean on the damn thing. He could hear her labouring up the stairs. Christ knows, she was no spring chicken herself. Those stairs were a chore. But he'd still hold down the button until he saw her in the doorway. "How did it go wrong for you?" she sometimes thought, as she looked into those pale, hate-filled eyes. Can a soul form a knot? And if it can, what can untie such a thing? How can it ever come loose? She wished she knew more about these things. She'd offered to move his bed into the sunroom so he could look out over the garden. He could watch the birds disporting in the bird bath, see the wind move through the trees. He might live long enough to watch the jonquils that she'd planted come up. She imagined that when you're dying, the beauty of such things would be focused like sun through a magnifying glass. Perhaps the bright spot it made in your heart would sear, but who would not welcome a burn like that? Surely we all long to be purified, and with nothing more to come, no more errors or losses or compromises, the spring garden could have the last word, the final say on it all. Wouldn't anyone want that? Well, not Jack. He refused to be moved, and when she tried to jolly him along, taking him by the arm, he actually struck out at her, as if she were trying to lure him into some form of involuntary euthanasia. So he stayed in his dark, musty room with its mouldy walls and its sweet stink of cancer. "Go ahead," she thought. "Eat up your own misery. Knock yourself out." She sat on the side of his bed and tried to get a few spoonfuls of pureed vegetables in his mouth, but he was like an infant, with the added faculty of cunning. After long exhortations, he finally opened his mouth for the spoon, then spat the stuff out in a spray all down his front, knowing she would have to clean up every spot. She could have cried. She could have killed him. One night, Helen rang from Alice Springs, where she worked on a remote Aboriginal community, teaching the poor little mites to read and write. Norma had never visited, but she almost thought she could hear the landscape in Helen's voice. Had her accent flattened and broadened? She sounded tough and relaxed, dusty, sunburnt. She sounded free. In her mind, Norma saw the immense, quiet desert sinking into dark, cockatoos crossing the vast light of dusk, and her heart ached in her chest. "So, how's Dad?" Helen asked. What she meant, of course, was, "How long?" Helen, ever the organised one, wanted to get an idea when she'd have to buy a flight. Norma let out a long exhalation. "I've no idea. He needs the oxygen more. He's weaker than he was, but it's so slow, Helen. I can't tell you." The phone was silent for a long time. "Won't go down without a fight, will he?" Stubborn as a Mallee bull. Then the talk turned to medications and metastases and all the rest, and Norma switched into nurse mode, a sort of autopilot, speaking in a rush. She was holding herself tight as a pillar in the middle of the living room, and all this medical stuff was tumbling out of her mouth, though it wasn't what she really wanted to say. Helen listened, or perhaps she didn't. She mm-hmmed at the appropriate times, and then zzzz, a cattle prod to Norma's kidneys. "What was that noise?" her sister asked. Norma felt tears pricking and took a moment to control the shake that threatened to disturb the efficient calm of her voice. "Oh, that's him. He wants something. Zzzz, zzzz, zzzz. I guess you'd better go. Thanks for the update." Helen paused. "So, how are you going anyway?" That's what Norma had been waiting for, that little question. Instead of all that stuff about Jack's cancer, she'd really just wanted to scream, "I'm dying here. I don't know how much longer I can take his abuse and the stink and the day after day after day. I'm not coping, not coping at all. Please help me." But Jack was hammering the buzzer and Helen was being polite. She didn't want to know about that, that her big sis was an emotional basket case. "Oh, you know, soldiering on," Norma said. "That's good. I honestly don't know how you put up with him. You know, we all appreciate it," by which she meant she and Norma's other three siblings, who were, if you summed up the distances, collectively as far away as the moon. Probably. "Zzz, zzz, zzz, all right," she shouted and hung up the phone. She went up the stairs and the sallow illumination of the 40-watt Osram was like the light in a bad dream. The day after, Norma had the vials for Jack's pump in her hand and the thought crossed her mind, what would it be like? She stopped in the middle of the room and looked down at the two little glass tears in the palm of her hand. The room spun for a moment and she had the dizzy sensation that she was hovering at the edge of a precipice. Then she shook herself and pushed the thought away. She would never do something like that. But a few days later she did. Taking the medicine from the shelf, she felt the same emotion as a child stealing chocolate from the corner shop. She couldn't believe she was doing it. How terrifying and exciting it was. She went down to the kitchen and the very light seemed diamond cut, sharp, edged with adrenaline. Her heart was beating so hard her ribs shook, but her hand was steady as she prepared the syringe, flicked her nail against the plastic, squeezed out a little drop. She would make an exceptionally professional junkie, she thought. No septicemia or collapsed veins for her, no sir. She plumped up a vein with a tea towel tourniquet and shot the stuff home before she had time to think twice. And, oh dear God, the sweet release as those opioid molecules sleeted through her blood buried her in a blizzard of painlessness. The clock kept quietly ticking over the kitchen sink. And here she was, at the bottom of the universe where nothing could touch her. She needed to lie down, but the walk to the bedroom was too much, so she slipped, like a drop scarf, to the lino. The cold floor was as comfortable as a feather bed. She closed her eyes, and like the Cheshire Cat, the rest of her faded away. She became nothing but one immense smile. Afterwards, she realised what a stupid, stupid mistake that had been. She could have spat on herself. She was so disgusted. Words were not vile enough to describe her. What was she thinking? She was no ignorant, screwed-up kid. She knew what addiction was about. Oh, the sick, excited feeling when she thought about those damn vials. Reminded her of something. It was exactly the same as something else she'd experienced a long, long time ago. She realised what it was as she was putting out the washing one day. It was love. First love. That's what it was. Winter blew in, scattering dead leaves and ragged clouds over the town, driving the birds before it. The air felt cold and full of wet, but still no rain came except random spats of oversized drops, like someone wringing out a wet dishcloth over the roof. On Sunday at church, the talk was all of survival and everyone bowed their heads in prayer. But Norma felt like a crow among doves. She was praying only for Jack's death. How could this go on? She'd rung every agency she could think of, but all she got was relieving nurse one day a fortnight. That was all she was eligible for. She stole his morphine again not long after that. She got up and pulled on her dressing gown and went down the hall to Jack's room. She shook the box into her palm, meaning to take two, like last time. 20 mils should do the trick, but 5 fell into her hand, and she found her fingers closing over them. 50 mils, she'd still be okay. She went back to bed, and by the light of the moon in her window, drew their contents one by one up into the syringe. She felt the weight of the cylinder as she held it up, needle glinting in the light, and she noticed she was wet between her legs. There was a moment of hot, dirty shame before she found the vein, and the rush came, obliterating everything. When the itching started the next day, she noted it with some professional surprise. She'd not expected the symptoms so soon. The jonquils had come up. How beautiful they are, Norma thought. I knew they'd be. Through her dull somnolence, she watched their bright heads tossing in the wind that came scouring through the garden, and vaguely feared for their petals. The clothesline spun aimlessly. She was a little clumsy opening the boxes, and quite a few of the vials spilled off the table and rolled onto the floor. When she came into his room and took his hand, Jack's head turned. "Mum," he whispered. "Mum, is that you?" She put her hand to his forehead and said, "Yes, Jack, it's me. It's okay. It's going to be okay." She was numb right through her body, just a dead weight. But her cheeks were wet. Salt ran into her mouth. "Mum, what's happening to me?" "It's okay." While the wind thrummed in the window pane, she emptied the first syringe into his arm. "It's okay." His head rolled over to watch his own arm as one by one she pushed in the needles. He looked startled. "It's okay." His eyes grew far away, and his pupils shrank to stars in negative. She waited, not looking at him, but gazing into the white patch of sky framed in the window. After a time she could not have measured, she realised she was alone in the room. So she went downstairs to make the necessary calls. She'd kept one box, just one, to get her through the arrangements and the funeral and the siblings flying in and departing before the things that needed to be said could be. And then she locked up the house forever, closing the door on all its ghosts, and got into Jack's van. The last vial was used up. She took a deep breath and started to drive, following the semi-trailers west, out of town, through the sun that flashed between the trees, and onwards, towards the great emptiness that lay ahead.
That was Salt by Piers Newton John, and it was read by Ella Watson Russell. As Norma experiences the final stages of caring for her dying father, we are allowed to observe the contrast of her internal thoughts with her external life. We all have an interior life, our own hidden reflections. This story allows the reader into the thoughts and actions of Norma as she performs the role of good daughter, caregiver, nurse, and sister. Yet beyond this external life, Norma experiences her own suffering. Through her suffering, we are invited to contemplate the role of a caregiver and what the role means to both the community and the carer herself. Norma's distress is especially apparent when she is speaking with her sister Helen. Here we are able to observe how Norma appears to the outsider and exactly how she feels inside herself. Towards the end of the conversation, we notice her frustration, as she wants to say that she isn't coping. Yet, she never says this out loud. Norma's perception of what people need to think about her drowns out her own personal requirement to speak with her sister about her true state of mind. As the reader is introduced into Norma's internal life, They are witness to the dark thoughts that occur when humans are experiencing immense stress and suffering. In Norma's case, the weight of caring for her seemingly ungrateful dying father becomes the reason such dark thoughts occur. We see her grapple with how she really feels in this situation and how she believes she should feel. Eventually, we see Norma convince herself that using her father's morphine won't hurt her, even though her experience as a nurse tells her otherwise. However, as she becomes more frustrated with her father and her circumstances, she begins to use more of the drug. As she ponders her use of the drug, she is struck by the similarity of the rush she gets from morphine to that of the rush of first love. In fact, there has been much research into these similarities and the neurological impacts that they have on our brains. The sentence describing the sick, excited feeling when she thought about those damn vials perfectly summarizes the connection. In this brief moment, we learn that perhaps Norma hasn't been loved for a long time. She is actually very lonely. Finally, are we meant to assume that Jack's calling for his mother makes Norma feel convinced her actions are proper, that her actions are justified? What do you think about Norma and her decisions in caring for her father? Consider what you would do and feel in a similar situation. As readers of this story, we are required to contemplate how Norma's situation bears down on her. The pressure ultimately gets the better of her and she acts in a way she never thought possible. In the concluding sentences, we understand that Norma feels free from these burdens and we assume that she is contented with her choices, even though others might not agree with them. Perhaps if we knew Norma in our own community, family, or as any part of our lives, we might be quick to pass judgment on the use of her father's medication to ease her own suffering. In the story, we are given the opportunity to understand all facets of Norma's life. We are challenged to think deeper, not only about Norma's choices, but what our own decisions might be in similar circumstances. That's all we have time for today. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Little Fictions on Air is produced by Bronwyn Meehan. The sound engineer for this is Caddy Hansen. I'm Kate Liston-Mills. Please join me again for Little Fictions on Air. Hey, hey.